Chuck just asked me to remind everyone about the tour of the Mars Sound Archive, which is going to start at 12:15. You can sign up during the break for that. Next, we have Dick Wright. Dick is an associate professor of music history at the University of Kansas Department of Music and Dance. He is beginning his 36th year as host of the Saturday morning jazz scene program on University of Kansas public radio station KANU-FM. He's the winner of numerous awards for his work in promoting Kansas City jazz. And in 1980, he presented his personal collection of over 20,000 jazz LPs to the University of Kansas, thus beginning the KU Jazz Archive.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. And you know, I've known Jim Seaver for now 40 years. I didn't know he could be that funny. I work with him all the time. And he was always very good to me because when I was in school in voice, I knew that whenever I gave a concert, there was a performance, I knew at least one person in the audience would be there who knew me. Jim was always there. We work together every day in the KU archives, and the two major collections are Jim's and mine. And just to tell you that I am not an archivist, I'm not a librarian, so I sort of stumble my way around the archives over at KU, just wanting to try and do something to keep the archives going and to preserve the wonderful recordings that we have. I was kind of, or I still am, sort of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. My degrees are in opera, and I teach jazz history. So if you can figure that out, I don't know how, what, I took a wrong turn in the road someplace and ended up teaching jazz history. So I love the music very much. I come to it from the perspective of a musician. I played my way through school, even though I was studying voice. And usually once a month, I would be called into the dean's office, Dean Thomas Gorton, bless his soul. He was a wonderful man, but he thought jazz had no place in academia. So I got my lecture about once a month, asking me to quit playing jazz up in the practice rooms and practice Puccini and Mozart and other things. So I had this very strong love for jazz, and so I began to look at the history of it. I knew that I was never going to be a player because at that time I thought I was going to be an opera singer. But I loved to read everything I could find voraciously about jazz and never knew that I would end up teaching jazz history as a profession. And I've been very lucky that the University of Kansas has put up with me and let me do this. And so I'd like to share with you this morning some of the wonderful recordings in jazz history. Now, I suppose all of us who are into jazz have our own particular favorites of what is great jazz. But I think almost everyone would accept the ones that I am going to present to you. And all of these holdings are in the archives at KU. Sometimes the original recording, many times it's an LP version of it put back out on the market. But I hope that you will enjoy some of these recordings that I think are certainly nominations for very historical and outstanding recordings in jazz. One of the most interesting things about teaching jazz is that we sort of have three strikes against us when we start out. We don't know really who started it, where it started, or when it started. So you can kind of have fun and make up your own history, I guess. No one can say anything against you. But I think almost everyone would think that it started certainly by the turn of the century, and that probably the first major city of jazz would be New Orleans. I'm sure there were other things going on around the country, but so many of the early jazz musicians, our early giants, were born in New Orleans, around New Orleans. So we look at a lot of those recordings as being the early great things on wax. So I'd like to start out, and I have just put little excerpts of recordings on here for you. It's very ironic that in almost every period of jazz, black artists have dominated. They have been the key players. Louis Armstrong, we get up to Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, all great artists, and most of them were black artists who sort of led the way. So it's rather ironic that the earliest jazz recording that most people will consider jazz, and then it's a little dubious, are recordings that were made by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, or affectionately known as the ODJB. And these were white artists, and they tried to copy what they had heard of black artists, and they were very famous in New Orleans. They moved on to Chicago, to New York, and even over to Europe to play for Crown Heads. So this is what we think, or many people accept, as possibly the earliest jazz recording. It's 1917, and that's a very important year in jazz because that's the year that Storyville was closed down in New Orleans, and many of the jazz players who had played in that area would move on to greener pastures, Chicago, St. Louis, New York, Kansas City, and so on. So here's just a little excerpt, and you can tell that the group itself looked at the music as sort of novelty type of music, and they might have been very surprised that they caught on so well with all the listeners around the country. But this is from their earliest date, 1917. It's a recording of the piece that was called the Liberty Stable Blues. And to show you that they were not so esoteric about it, you'll hear the clarinet player cluck like a chicken, and the trumpet player try to whinny like a horse, the trombone player trying to sound something like a donkey. So this is thought to be at least one of the earliest recordings of jazz, just a little bit of this Liberty Stable Blues. Kind of an interesting recording in the history of jazz, as we say, maybe the earliest thing we can think of that's called jazz, and a lot of people didn't really think they deserved to be called jazz. But the original Dixieland Jazz Band. Then 1922, rather historic recording by the first all-black jazz group. As I mentioned to you, the ODJB were white artists. The first black group was under the direction of Kid Ory, who would later become famous with Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. But Ory recorded in 1922 a piece here that's called Ory's Creole Trombone. And historically, it's kind of important, we hear it on a lot of other recordings, but to hear what really was called the tailgate style of trombone playing. Supposedly, the story goes that because jazz was used functionally in New Orleans, someone might hire jazz musicians, they'd get on a wagon, roll around New Orleans, stop at a corner and play, till you gathered a group, and then someone could either sell some snake oil or talk about a political rally or whatever they wanted to. But the story goes that the poor trombone player was always stuck at the end of the wagon over the tailgate so he wouldn't run anybody through with the slide of the trombone. So after a while, this sort of began to be synonymous with New Orleans-style jazz, tailgate trombone. So here's a little sampling of Kid Ory's style, and this was used by so many trombone players, and this is called, again, Ory's Creole Trombone. So every trombone player learned that kind of style of playing, that ripping sound, and that was a tradition for the New Orleans style. Some next very historic recordings were done, of course, by Joe King Oliver and his Creole Jazz Band, and most collectors and historians and people who know much about jazz really look at these as sort of the beginnings of sort of serious jazz playing to listen to. King Oliver's group was wonderful for a couple of reasons. Number one, it had a woman playing piano, which was probably the first woman of note in jazz. Her name was Lil Hardin. Later she would marry Louis Armstrong. But also it had Louis Armstrong playing second cornet. Now, when King Oliver, when Storyville shut down, King Oliver moved on, and he was playing in Chicago, and he called for Louis to join him. I think probably that King Oliver knew that Louis was going to be one of the great players and was probably better than he was already. So what better way to keep your finger on him than to have him play second cornet in your band? So he did play second cornet, but one of the interesting things to people listening to these recordings are the little breaks that the two of them took together as a duet. And everybody was sort of astounded that how do they sound so good in those little breaks, like one knew what the other was doing. Well, they did, because Louis later on confessed that they practiced a lot of those breaks that they took, so they knew what they were doing. Also, Louis said that many times King Oliver would sort of nudge him when he was playing a certain phrase rhythmically, and that meant that I'm going to play something like this on the break, so think in a hurry, think up something that'll fit with it in the second part. So again, very, very outstanding group, having both King Oliver and Louis Armstrong, but having also Lil Hardin on piano. This is the Sobbin' Blues, and you'll hear those little breaks with the two of them together. Very simple. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. You are right. I changed my mind when I recorded this, and I forgot to change it on here. Thank you. You're right. I played the wrong one. I was going to use Sobbin' Blues and play the other one, but forgot to change it here. Next, I'd like you to hear some Fletcher Henderson. In the history of jazz, most people think of this as maybe being the first really outstanding big band in jazz. Fletcher Henderson had been very lucky to have a very, very fine education and was in New York in the mid-20s to do graduate work at Columbia, and like everybody going away to school, didn't have enough money to get by, so he had a job with one of the first great publishing houses, black publishing houses of music, headed by W.C. Handy and Harry Pace. And it was his job to be sort of a song plugger. And when Harry Pace broke away from this liaison with W.C. Handy, he formed the first sort of major black recording company, Black Swan Records. And Fletcher Henderson would go with him and would do a lot of work for him, finding some of the talent, and two of the early talented people he found were the great Bessie Smith and Ethel Waters. And he would find them, help them with the material. He would make the arrangements in the background. His band would play and did probably everything but clean up the studio when it was over. And so many people said, well, why don't you have a band of your own all the time instead of just for recording? So he did form a band. And at the very beginning, it was difficult for him to do a lot of arrangements. Later on, his arrangements will be highly touted and even taken by people like Benny Goodman, who really came to be known as the King of Swing from playing a lot of those Fletcher Henderson arrangements. But Fletcher was able to have some very fine musicians, including Coleman Hawkins, who would be looked at as the first great saxophone player in jazz. But also Louis Armstrong. Once Louis and Lil had married, Lil sort of got on Louis's case and said, are you going to play second cornet all your life to Joe King Oliver? So he would break away and he would spend some time here with the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra and sort of change the whole approach even to Coleman Hawkins' style of playing. And of course, Louis would go on to be our first really great soloist in jazz, leading the way with solo improvisation. But here's just a little sampling of Fletcher Henderson's orchestra from very early times, 1924. And the arrangement is done here by Don Redman. Fletcher had hired him to play saxophone, but also to do many of the arrangements because, again, Fletcher was busy trying to find work and to find people to play in his band. So just a little bit here of Fletcher Henderson's orchestra, and this is called Copenhagen. This next recording is, I think, historically very important because two of the earliest names in jazz would be Joe King Oliver and Jelly Roll Morton. The first supposedly great artist in jazz was a man that we have no recordings of, so we can't know really what he would sound like, but Buddy Bolden was thought to be the first great player, but we do have recordings then of these two men who had come along just a little bit later, Joe King Oliver and Jelly Roll Morton. Jelly had his own group a little bit later on called the Red Hot Peppers, and of course, King Oliver having the Creole Jazz Band. But they went into the studios together and recorded here a very interesting composition of Jelly Roll Morton. He was probably, maybe to a lot of people, better known as maybe a first grade jazz composer than as maybe really a great piano player. He was very good, but I feel that maybe Earl Hines was really the first really great piano player in jazz. But they would go into the studios and record together, and this number is a very famous composition by Jelly Roll Morton, and it's still played today. Modern versions are done by big bands and small groups alike. But this is a famous piece called the King Porter Stomp, and two jazz greats together, and I think very historically, Joe King Oliver on cornet and Jelly Roll Morton piano. This next recording features Louis Armstrong. He would have his hot fives and hot sevens, and again, these are looked at by collectors as some of the great early jazz and stylistically ahead of a lot of other groups. And on one of the occasions when Louis recorded, there are a couple of stories that float around about how this happened, but this piece, it's called Heebie Jeebies, is looked at by many people as maybe being the earliest example of what we call scat singing, which is, again, where the singer deliberately forgets the words of a composer and sings nonsense syllables, whatever, to get the voice out and to try and act like an instrument. Two stories floated around on this particular recording. One claimed, I think it was Kid Ory claimed, that Louis Armstrong had memorized the song, the lyrics to it, but forgot when he got to the second time through, and so had to resort to just making up some words. Another story by someone who was supposedly at the session claims that Armstrong had written the words on a piece of paper and that he somehow touched the stand or something while he was singing and the piece of paper dropped off on the floor, so he just sort of made up words. Probably both of those are false, and I think he knew what he was doing all along to do this. But a little sampling then of what we think of as maybe the earliest, one of the earliest examples of scat singing. This is Armstrong and Heebie Jeebies. Second time through.
Father's got the heebie jeebies there. Keep guys, keep birds, keep that fire. Leap it, diddle, 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 keep guys, keep birds, diddle, 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 come on down. Do that then, they call the heebie jeebies there. Sweet mama.
This next recording that I think is very important is looked at maybe the best solo ever taken by the young white cornetist Bix Beiderbecke. Louis and Bix were examples of sort of the two streams that jazz has taken down through the years, sort of a hot approach or a cool approach. Louis being sort of the hot player and Bix being the cool player, and it would carry on to like Coleman Hawkins versus Lester Young, their approach. Benny Goodman versus Artie Shaw and their approach to playing. So this has sort of continued down through the years. Bix is looked at as maybe the first important white player and maybe the person that a lot of the myths have grown up about jazz, a guy who died very young and who lived in the fast lane and was a very important player. And his approach was, again, that of sort of a cool, laid-back player. He was much admired by black artists as well as white artists. And so this is a recording that most people pick as his best solo of all. And it's been described by some people as sounding like someone walking over eggshells, trying to pick their way through. And it sounds like this might have been played 100 times till Bix got just the right notes to fit what he wanted to do. So this is Frankie Trumbauer, who has an association here with Kansas City, and his son taught at the conservatory here. Frankie Trumbauer's group, but you'll hear this Bix Beiderbecke solo on cornet. This is Singing the Blues. Thank you. Another very important recording in jazz history is one made by Louie and the Hot Seven, and it's called the Potato Head Blues. And I've heard many modern trumpet players today, Wynton Marsalis and other trumpet players, doing workshops in which they would play this solo note for note. So it was a piece that many trumpet players would learn and play just for themselves or just for friends because it was such a great solo. I'm going to play here, there are two solos by Louie, one at the beginning and then one that comes near the end. And this is what we call a stop chorus. You'll hear when Louie starts out with his solo, the band play on the first beat and then two bars later we'll play on the first beat. So they leave Louie sort of wide open by himself. That's what we mean by a stop chorus. The other people stop and the soloist goes on. But this is truly an outstanding solo of Louis Armstrong. This is it was recorded in 1927, and this is the Potato Head Blues, the famous stop chorus by Louis. It's a very good, clean recording, and again, that famous solo that everybody has copied down through the years. This next recording that I think is very important to jazz history features the Duke Ellington Orchestra. And this is a recording that was made in 1927. The piece was called Creole Love Call. And what's interesting about it, when Ellington would be asked about his piano playing, you know, he was a good piano player, but he would sort of shy away from that and say, well, really, my instrument is the orchestra. And it certainly was. The way that Ellington could put together colors in different instruments and get such great sounds that way. Well, he had an idea in 1927 to use the voice as an instrument. And so he was able to talk a woman who really hadn't done much jazz at all, Adelaide Hall, to come into the studios and to try and sound like Bubber Miley, his wonderful trumpet player. So she was game and she tried it, and what comes out is a pretty interesting recording here of the voice being used as a sort of an instrument in the orchestra. So this from 1927 is Duke Ellington's Creole Love Call. This is the real thing, Bubber Miley on trumpet. Thank you. Dick would do the same thing in the 50s when he would talk the great gospel singer Mahalia Jackson into coming into the studios and recording the famous Black, Brown, and Beige. But this was quite unusual at this time, and Edley did her best to sound like Bubba Miley's trumpet. Incidentally, also, just about a month ago, the Smithsonian Orchestra was here in Kansas City, and they played 22 of the original Duke Ellington arrangements. It was really something to hear. This next recording is sort of a replay of King Oliver and Jelly Roll Morton together. This is the bringing together of Louis Armstrong and Earl Father Hines. Earl recorded with Louis Armstrong here in 1928, and they would go into the studios and do this wonderful duet that once again is thought by many to be an outstanding recording of the time. So this is Louis Armstrong with Earl Father Hines on the piano, and it's called Weatherbird. Earl's nickname is Earl Father Hines, and he perfected what was later called the trumpet style of piano. When he took a solo, he played the melody, he doubled it, thumb and little finger, and he was very good at doing it at any tempo, but that sort of became the trademark of his style. This next recording has to do with a group around this area, Walter Page's Blue Devils. Walter Page was a bass player who would later on become more famous, probably with Count Basie. When Basie was going strong in the 30s, the four people in the rhythm section, Basie on piano, Freddie Green guitar, Walter Page bass, and Joe Jones drums, was always referred to as the million-dollar rhythm section. Well, this is the Blue Devils. It is one of the first known groups in the area. It was known as a territory band. They traveled around Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, neighboring states, sort of made the circle of all the different places. They went into the studios and only recorded two pieces of music. Two recordings is all they made, so they're rather historic. And it's interesting to note that the pianist on the recordings is Count Basie. Later on, when they would do a battle of the bands with Benny Moten, a very famous name here in Kansas City, Benny Moten was beaten badly in the battle of the bands, and it upset him so much that he began to hire away all of the Blue Devils until he eventually even got Walter Page, the leader, to come with him. And so the end of the Blue Devils, and Basie and Walter Page would then meet up again with Benny Moten. And then when Benny Moten died tragically in 35, when the doctor doing a tonsillectomy slipped and cut the jugular and he bled to death, Basie would sort of take over the remnants of that band. And from then on, it was the Count Basie band, and Walter Page was the bass player. But here is the group, the original group, Walter Page's Blue Devils, and one of the two pieces they recorded in 1929. It's called There's a Squabblin'.
Thank you.
incidentally, Walter Page on there takes one of the very early string bass solos. Most in early jazz, New Orleans jazz, it would have been the use of the brass bass, the tuba. Then eventually, as we go through the periods and the change in the size of groups, tuba players would switch to string bass and the tuba would be phased out. But on in the band, Walter played string bass, tuba, and baritone sax and used all three in the role of a bass. This next recording was made, jumping up now to 1933, by what today is still looked at as maybe the greatest technical player in jazz and maybe in any kind of music you can name. It was a blind piano player by the name of Art Tatum. And Art Tatum came on the scene really when we were all were getting ready to go into what would be called the swing era, which is approximately 35 to 45. But he would come along during that time, but he was so astounding that everybody paid much attention to him besides the big bands. He was legally blind. It is said that he also not only had perfect pitch, but almost total recall, so that anything he heard, he could play. Bud Powell, who would be the first great modern piano player in jazz, said that the first time his brother played a recording of Art Tatum for him, he wanted to know who the two piano players were on the recording. So it's an astounding technique. And this is recorded here when he was only 23 years old in 1933. This is a little bit of Art Tatum doing the Tiger Rag, his first recording session. Great technical player who died in the mid-50s and left a great legacy of recordings. Next is the woman who is called by most people the greatest jazz singer of all, Billie Holiday. It's very interesting about Billie. When you talk about voices, there were probably, down through the years, hundreds of better voices. She didn't have really much of a range, but there was something about Billie Holiday that appealed to everybody. Probably the fact that the kind of songs she sang really laid her soul bare. She sang about things like God Bless the Child That Has His Own. Supposedly, she wrote this piece, the lyrics, after her mother refused to loan her any money. And she said, well, God bless the child that has his own. And supposedly, when one of the men, and she had a series of bad men that she would team up with who took advantage of her and were physically harmful to her. But one of them came home one night with lipstick on his collar and tried to explain how it got there, and she wrote the song, Don't Explain. So maybe that's why she appeals to so many people, that she sings the songs are really kind of herself. Well, this is her first really important recording. She had recorded in 1933 with Benny Goodman's orchestra. John Hammond, who would be Benny Goodman's brother-in-law, suggested that he ought to use her. So she sings a couple of innocuous pop songs, but then she started in the mid-30s doing a series of recordings with the great pianist Teddy Wilson. And this would last almost to the end of the 30s and would give her not only national but international fame. And it would either be under Billie's name or under Teddy's name. And about the only way you could tell the difference, if it was under Teddy's name, usually it was an instrumental at the beginning, Billie in the middle, and instrumental at the end. And if it was Billie's date, it'd be Billie, instrumental, and then Billie again. So this is one of the very fine songs in that first recording date with Teddy Wilson. And some of the great players, Roy Eldridge on trumpet, and Benny Goodman, who she had recorded with in 1933, Ben Webster. So those recording dates she would do with Teddy Wilson were full of great jazz artists behind her. So this is Billie doing Miss Brown to You. Thank you. This next recording also comes to mid-30s, and it's a rather historical recording. Most records, of course, were 10-inch variety or a few 12-inch variety in jazz. But Duke Ellington would lose his mother in the mid part of the 30s, and in his grief, he sat down and wrote a composition that ended up taking up both sides of 2/78s, in other words, four sides. It was in four movements. So this has to be certainly one of the earliest extended type of works. It was called Reminiscent in Tempo, and again, it was to honor his mother who had just died. They were very close. So historically, this is an important recording, one of the longest of early pieces, and it's just a little bit of the first movement. Again, it's called Reminiscent in Tempo. Very important work of Duke and done in honor of his mother who had just died. In 1936, a rather important recording was done, series of recordings, by Benny Goodman. Benny by now was becoming very, very famous. He had heard a wonderful young piano player, a black piano player by the name of Teddy Wilson, and would add him for specialty numbers when the trio, Benny Goodman on clarinet, Gene Krupa, the great drummer, and Teddy Wilson would play. Then in 1936, he discovered another wonderful young black player by the name of Lionel Hampton, who played vibes primarily, but also played two-fingered piano and played drums. But these caused quite a stir because here we have a mixed group, two white artists, two black artists together. So this is rather important that way. But besides that, they were all four really wonderful musicians. So they would put out a series of really great recordings. Just a little sampling of one, the old standard Moon Glow. I don't know if you've ever heard many of the stories about Benny Goodman. There are a lot of funny stories out about him. He was supposedly one of the most absent-minded persons in the world. And I think one of the funniest stories was supposedly he and a friend got into a taxi cab. They were going to go someplace together, and they started talking. And the driver was patient for a short time, and finally he turned around in the cab and said, "Gentlemen, where do you want to go?" And Benny Goodman said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And he got out his billfold, paid the cab driver, and they both got out. He thought they had gone someplace already. So he was famous for these absent-minded stories. This next recording is very, very important because it brings us the great sound of Lester Young, who really turned the jazz world around in the 30s. Up to that time, the mid-30s, the style to follow was that of Coleman Hawkins, the great tenor player, who had a big sound with vibrato and liked to wallow around on the bottom of the horn. And while he was in Europe, on the scene would come Lester Young. Lester had taken his place with Fletcher Henderson, and no one was happy with him because he didn't have the sound that Coleman Hawkins did. But he eventually would find his niche when he comes into the Count Basie band. Count Basie's band was going to be signed to a contract. John Hammond had come and heard the band, said, "You need to go east. We need to get you recorded." But while he was trying to work with them, another company slipped in and signed up Count Basie to do a ridiculous amount of recordings for not much money. So what John Hammond did, he wanted to get them in the studios first, so he put a small group into the studios, and since Count Basie was signed to this other label, they called the group not Count Basie's small group, but this was called the Jones Smith Incorporated Group, which was the drummer, Joe Jones, and the trumpet player, Carl Smith. Basie's at the piano, Walter Page bass, and of course Joe Jones drums, a wonderful rhythm section. But the really important thing then is the first recordings of the great Lester Young on tenor. Well, my time is up. I had just a couple more recordings I was going to play that you're certainly very familiar with. If you know, you think about jazz at all, the famous Benny Goodman concert in Carnegie Hall, which was a big deal, and Coleman Hawkins' brilliant recording of Body and Soul when he came back from Europe that brought him right back to the top. So again, those are some of my favorite early recordings, and I think most people would agree they're very good and certainly historically very important. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.